The first confirmation that we, the public, had that the man had landed on the moon didn't come from the moon. It came from Houston, Texas. Houston, we copy you down, Eagle. Then Armstrong says, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. And then in utter silence, Neil Armstrong, age 38, Buzz Aldrin Jr., age 39, turned to each other, smiled, and shook hands. They were too far away, far too away, to hear that avalanche of sound, that roar that shook the windows down at Central Park. Tens of thousands of Americans who had been sitting there breathless on the grass in Central Park rose to their feet and let go with a kind of cheering I had not heard before. Anybody remember seeing this picture? Do you remember what you thought when you saw this picture? My friend Bill Whittle saw a lot more than I saw in it. And he saw a lot more than I think anyone else saw in it. And I want to read you, if I can, what his thoughts were about this picture. It's a picture of Armstrong in the lunar module after walking on the moon. They had repressurized the Eagle and removed their helmets. He looks very tired. He needs a shave and no doubt a shower as well. His eyes appear swollen and red. But the look on his face is just transcendental. Eyes and smile are not those of a 38-year-old steely-eyed missile man. Neil Armstrong looks exactly like a six-year-old kid seeing a shiny new bike in front of the Christmas tree on Christmas morning. The blue eyes appear to be a little watery. A first time at Disneyland look. You're just so happy you're about to cry. That photo is one of the most remarkable pictures ever taken of anyone. There's joy and deep pride you must feel after realizing that you have just done the single most difficult task in the history of the world. There's an overwhelming sense of relief, strong enough to come forward half a century and still knock the wind out of you. 600 million people who could get to a television had watched this man carry the weight of everyone, the dreams and sweat of the 375,000 people who worked on Project Apollo. Neil looks like a man who has the satisfaction of having carried the weight for all of that time and finished the job without screwing the pooch. I was kind of confused about what to share with you guys on this talk, and watching that, I just flat had to share that with you. But there's more. Apollo's test schedule was extremely complex, with each test flight depending on the last in order to move on. We're talking a little over 8.5 years to go from a little suborbital flight with a Mercury Redstone all the way to landing on the moon. Now, at long last, it was time for someone to ride a Saturn V. But there was a problem. The lunar module wasn't ready yet, and time was running out. It takes too long. In fine print here, Whittle discusses all of the various changes that had to be made to the schedule. So they improvised. They would delay a manned test of both the lunar module and the command service module in Earth orbit. They delayed that, and they threw an entire mission and schedule out the window. They didn't do it. They had a moon rocket. They had a moon capsule. They had a moon crew. So they could go to the moon without a lunar module. It was the boldest most brilliant decision made during the entire Apollo program. Apollo would go to the moon in December of 1968. When they came home, if they came home, there would be exactly one calendar year left to fulfill the promise of JFK, with still two missions needed before the first landing could be attempted. When I heard the cheering in Central Park on July 20th, 1969, when Apollo landed on the moon, I said I would not hear a sound like that again. Last year, I was watching the first flight of Falcon Heavy. Outside the SpaceX control room, a huge crowd of people, almost all in their 20s and 30s, had gathered to watch the launch live. The sound they made when it cleared the pad was tremendous. The roar they made at first stage separation was heartwarming. But when those two booster rockets simultaneously dropped into frame to land on pillars of fire, the sound that came out of that room full of millennials was exactly the same sound I heard in 1969 coming out of Central Park. It's a different vibe this time, less tense, a lot more fun. You launch a candy apple red convertible complete with space-suited mannequin, David Bowie on the radio. You're not just doing something that the Chinese or Russians or European and NASA could not do. You're having a blast. When the SpaceX twin boosters landed, a 20-something friend of mine texted me and said, "This was our moon landing." I disagree. Landing in Mars will be your moon landing. The young engineers and technicians at SpaceX might be the ones doing it. And we Apollo kids, contrary to what we thought 5 years ago, are gonna live to see it. Our great-grandfathers went to the moon using slide rules, genius, and guts. We've been waiting for 50 years for someone to go further than we did. We Apollo kids dare you to do it. We double dare you. These were just some tidbits out of 5 hours of video that you can see on YouTube. And if you're an Apollo geek, it's really something cool to watch. Okay, now we're going to talk about me. These are my words. With Apollo moon landing in the news, I'm compelled to share some observations. First, the question of courage to take risks. The decision to use lunar orbit rendezvous, the method that was used instead of going to the moon directly and coming back, that decision, which required rendezvous around the moon, that decision was made 3.4 years before anybody had made a rendezvous around the Earth. Can you imagine somebody making a decision like that and getting Grumman building the lunar module and get, 3.4 years before we found that you could rendezvous around the Earth, that was our plan. We don't think like that anymore, do we? The very first time humans flew on the huge Saturn V, they flew to orbit the moon 2,000 times higher than humans had ever flown. And that was the first ride on a Saturn V. In spite of the crazy risks, America's 1960s space systems were statistically the safest transportation system there were. There were no fatalities or injuries while attempting to fly out of the atmosphere with any of the 7 different rocket systems flown by Americans. The next 8 slides are what I use in many of my space talks that I give, and it's to compare the early manned space programs in the 60s to what followed. They end with my answer to, can NASA now take us to the moon or Mars? And I think they answer that question. In the 60s, 9 manned space launch systems were built and flown. 7 of those were United States of America. Vostok, Gagarin, Alan Shepard on a Redstone. Anybody have seen a Redstone? It's about that big around. Yeah, it's set on a milk stool. John Glenn's in the Atlas. General Joe Engel, who I just hugged back here, he flew the X-15. Unfortunately, he didn't go to space in it. Only Joe Walker went above 100 kilometers. But because it went above 100 kilometers, it was the 4th manned space launch, manned space rocket system to put people out of the atmosphere. And then, of course, there's Titan. And then there's Soyuz. Well, Soyuz, does that sound familiar? That's a Russian rocket. Let me say that again. It was flown in 1967, and it's the only ride to orbit now. If you had a 67 car, and it's the only car you can drive now,